A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk a little bit about a very complex and morally vexed issue from the end of the Second World War, and that is the fate of those accused of collaboration and their treatment in newly liberated countries in Western and Eastern Europe. It's complex because collaboration could mean all sorts of things. It could mean people that were simply helpful to occupying forces, such as the Nazis who occupied France or the Netherlands, or Italian forces in Greece or the Balkans. Or it could mean people that were complicit in their crimes, such as the Vichy regime and other collaborators, the Quisling regime in Norway, for example. And obviously there's a gulf of difference between the two. And one of the most scapegoated categories of collaborator were the, it turns out, hundreds of thousands of women who had relationships with German soldiers in occupied countries across Europe. Reading Keith Lowe's Savage Continent, the research tends to suggest that the numbers of women who had relationships with the soldiers of the Wehrmacht was exceedingly high, something like 10% in Norway. The explanation that he puts forward, and I think this probably is the case, but I don't know how you can ever quantify it, is that the Germans were actually quite attractive. They had and were more attractive than the vanquished menfolk of the French, Belgian, Dutch, Norwegian armies, and so on and so forth. And this lined up various women who'd had relationships with German soldiers with terrible retribution when the war ended. France is, stands out particularly for this, women being publicly humiliated, having their hair shaved in market squares, being violently assaulted, a huge spike in sexual violence against women happens in this period of time as well. And if you think even for a moment about the functioning of the male psyche in these instances, the answer becomes abundantly clear. Men who had been conquered by the Nazis felt profoundly emasculated, and then there was a second emasculation again, losing the women from your community to the conqueror. Was a blow to pride, a blow to the ego, a blow to self-worth that could never be undone in full. I've spoken in talking about Vietnam and the French recolonization of Vietnam, that seems to have had an awful lot to do with national pride of the French reeling in Vietnam, particularly reeling from the blows of the mother country being invaded by the Germans and them being conquered during the Second World War in French Asia by the Japanese. So anyway, I digress. The way in which Allied occupiers dealt with collaborators and dealt with justice towards collaborators is hugely ambiguous. British and American administrators seem to have turned a blind eye, given all the other challenges they had to deal with. It was an unnecessary hassle to try to intervene in internecine French or Belgian or Dutch or Italian politics. Also, they had an absence of sympathy for those accused of collaboration and thought that perhaps the best thing to do is to allow local communities to sort it out their own way. There were accounts of British soldiers and American soldiers seeing the retribution that was unfolding and feeling profoundly uncomfortable by it, and seeing very little moral distinctions between the mob violence of the Nazis and the mob violence of the newly liberated countries. In France, there is a race to prove that France has had some significant role in its own liberation, as the German occupying forces realise that the only option is to retreat to Germany's borders and defend the Reich, and France is liberated. Very quickly, there is a new wave of young men joining the resistance. Old resistance fighters who had survived the entire war undercover, were wise enough to maintain a low profile and didn't spend days on end whizzing around in commandeered cars with Sten guns, trying to find collaborators. And the women of the resistance, who were skilled radio operators, bomb makers, marksmen, all the rest of it, were shoved out of the resistance in its entirety, and including the communist resistance, as they were told, essentially, the men have returned now, don't worry, the situation is under control. Now, given the sheer size of the Nazi occupation, from the Pyrenees at one point all the way to the Volga River, and from Norway to the Peloponnese Islands, it's inconceivable that even with over 10 million soldiers in uniform, that the Nazis could have run all this without an auxiliary army of collaborators. The active collaborators, studies ever really been done, but you're probably talking within the hundreds of thousands, and the kind of level of societal social collaboration where people simply didn't actively resist because it's just not possible to do so, or accommodated the occupying forces, or did their best to get along with them, or that kind of thing, then you're talking about an even bigger number of people across Europe. And collaboration, active collaboration, is synonymous mainly with Western Europe. And if you think about it, the conditions in Western Europe are really quite different. In Western Europe, governments are largely intact, as a result of the Nazi invasion, whereas in Eastern Europe, in Poland, the Baltic states, Ukraine, Belarus, places like that, governments are destroyed and the state is destroyed. The idea that people are collaborating with the regime in Western Europe suggests that they're doing it on not an equal basis, but a slightly less unequal basis. Whereas in Poland, collaboration any non-compliance resulted in incarceration in a concentration camp or a swift death. So it's a different story altogether. And it implies that in Western Europe, collaboration was largely based on consent. Collaborators, it goes without saying then, were deeply hated in their societies that they lived in. And the post-war popular press that developed, rehabilitated itself very quickly in Western European countries, speaks about them in almost like fascistic terms as being people need to be removed or cleansed from society, vermin, mad dogs or inferior elements. And some British officers said that there was almost a kind of like a religious fervour surrounding the persecution of the collaborator. And again, once again, if you think about it in emotional terms, this makes sense, that the collaborator who could be identified and accused of their crimes was a way of transferring guilt, transferring shame, transferring trauma from the community at large, all of whom who could be said to have collaborated or consented or acquiesced in different ways. And the creation of a scapegoat in a kind of a typical witch hunt manner helped to kind of exercise, or it was an attempt to exercise, some of these collective demons. The breadth of social distinctions that were included within the category of collaborator was huge. There were wealthy industrialists and financiers who across Europe who had collaborated. Policemen, and in France, the gendarmes who had enforced the Nazi laws, as they were had been instructed to by their by the Vichy government, and the entrepreneurs who made money from Nazi contracts, cafe owners and bar owners who served the occupying forces drinks. The journalists and broadcasters and filmmakers across Europe who disseminated Nazi propaganda, and entertainers, the French and other occupied entertainers who entertained the troops. This meant the scope for revenge and reprisal across Europe was immense. And there was nowhere quite like Italy for the scale of violence. Italy had been one of the European countries, such as Greece, and to some extent France, that descends into civil war at the end of the Second World War. Italy is, courtesy of Mussolini, and his jailbreak, helped by Hitler's commandos, divided into two states following the Allied invasion. And from April 1945 onwards, a period of time in Italian called the Eparazione began, and it was what Keith Lowe refers to as a frenzy of revenge, beginning with attacks on anything associated with fascism. And bear in mind, fascism had a pedigree in Italy going back to 1920.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Two. So that probably meant that you were talking about a large section of the population. In the last 2 years of the war, fascist violence in northern Italy and fascist terror in northern Italy had been at its height. For much of the life of Mussolini's fascist Italy, the fascist terror really never paralleled its equivalents in Nazi Germany, except for the last 2 years of the war, when the terror organisation, the Black Brigades, made sure that there was nothing but unflinching loyalty to the faltering Mussolini. So in northern Italy, in Emilia-Romagna, Veneto and Piedmont, there were thousands and thousands of extrajudicial killings. The British Army reported that in Milan, in the run-up to VE Day, so in early May, 500 people were executed. 1,000 in Turin, and there were other unreported mass killings that took place. When you compare it to other countries, you're looking at Belgium. The number of collaborators killed in Belgium was 265, about 100 in Holland. The France, far larger, and having had the Vichy regime to contend with, 9,000 people were killed. But the statistics, and they're statistics when you're looking at mass killings, there's always a kind of different methodological approaches and areas of doubt, but somewhere between 12 and 20,000 people were killed in predominantly northern Italy in the months after the end of the war. So it's an enormous spike in violence. And the speed with which it happens is interesting in its own right. 9,000 of these killings happened in April and May 1945. So compacted into a very short space of time. Much of this is uncoordinated, spontaneous. There is nobody... and no one authority managing it. But the speed of it tells us something. And probably what was happening here is that there was an understanding that Allied armies would soon sweep in within a matter of weeks, if not days, and then collaborators would be handed over to a judicial system. The judicial system in Italy was so compromised, there was so little faith in it, that there was an assumption that if you hand over the fascists will get a slap on the wrist, spend a few months in jail, and then they'll be out again, and fascism will endure. So anti-fascist partisans said, well, kill them, every last one of them. That's the only way that you can, A, be assured of the kind of justice you seek, and B, make sure that Italy is kind of fascist-proof for the future, though some might argue that that hasn't really worked out either. The partisans in Italy were pretty justified in their views, because when the Duce Mussolini was removed and the fascist regime fell in southern Italy, Marshal Badoglio the former fascist managed to rehabilitate the administrators of the fascist regime very quickly, and it was observable that fascists found a way to re-enter everyday life as newly reinvented Democrats. There was still a strong fascist element in the Italian police. Communists and anyone on the left were still harassed and imprisoned arbitrarily. And you could hear in towns across southern Italy fascist songs and fascist anthems still being sung in public. So it was unsurprising then that partisans in the north would adopt this attitude. So despite the fact that there's a spike of violence in Italy, across Europe, the purge of collaborators is far from comprehensive. And within half a decade, most of those who have been accused of serious acts of collaboration with the Nazis are given slaps on the wrists, relatively light prison sentences, or their cases are dismissed. So there were 311,000 cases that were investigated in France, of which only 95,000 resulted in any kind of punishment at all. Half of those, only 45,000, received a prison sentence. The most common punishment was some kind of curtailment of civil rights, such as the right to vote, or kind of the curtailment of French citizenship, which, you know, within French culture is enormously important, and it was quite seen as a symbolic punishment. And there was in 1947 an amnesty. And the majority of the people who'd been imprisoned in the first place, who were probably of the more serious category of offenders, were set free. And then in 1951, there's another amnesty. And the only people remaining in prison were 1,500 of the most serious war criminals. And the civil service purge that happened at the end of the war, the 11,000 civil servants who were fired from their jobs were given their jobs back over the course of the next 6 years or so. Why does this happen? Well, in part because societies need people who can do things in order to function. They need civil servants, they need army officers, they need policemen, that kind of thing, and they can't be too picky about these people's moral or ideological past. Secondly, the real crimes that France collaborated in, Vichy France, not the Free French, collaborated in during the war, were things such as the Holocaust, and specifically the Holocaust, but that not alone. And the further one could distance oneself culturally and socially from the memories of the war and the memories of the Holocaust, so much the better. Again, in Holland, where I think 12,000 Dutchmen joined the SS, half of the people punished in Holland suffered only a removal of voting rights, while most of the other half were imprisoned, but generally for a short period of time. In Belgium, their sentences were harsher, with 48,000 being handed out, of which 2,340 were life in sentences, but that was only 12% of the total number of cases investigated at all. The Belgian judges gave out 2,940 death sentences, but all of these, bar 242, were commuted. So there seems to be a desire very quickly to return to some kind of status quo, some kind of, for want of a better word, normalcy within Europe. And the idea of continuing with what would be seen at the time as dredging up the past was seen as a political liability by the governments who prosecuted these crimes. And bear in mind, many of the judiciary, police, etc. were tainted by their own complicities. But actually, the populations of Western Europe were extremely angry that the crimes of the collaborators were not being fully investigated. So it was electorally unpopular. And it was only really in Norway that the population seemed to have vented, have had their kind of satisfaction, where something like about 45,000 punishments were handed down, about 50% of the cases that were investigated. Justice obviously varies wildly from nation to nation, but that's because conditions in different countries vary wildly, and the occupations in different countries vary wildly. But one thing that was common throughout Europe was the need to create these myths by the end of the war. The idea that most of France had been united in opposition to the occupiers, or Italy, or the Netherlands, or wherever. Whereas the reality was that active and passive collaboration were widespread, and simple day-to-day accommodation with the occupiers were widespread. Once you could single out collaborators and point the finger at them, it actually had part in the creation of a new sense of national post-war cohesion, particularly as people rapidly sought to distance themselves from the Nazis' crimes. And we must always remember the Holocaust isn't simply a German crime, it is a European crime. And this was perhaps not even uppermost in the motivations of people, but certainly it can't be discounted as something that was important. Now, okay, very quickly before we finish up, I just want to remind you guys that you can get a 10% discount off all AudioPie podcast recordings for study and schools because of my wonderful relationship with them. And you can, I'll play a little bit of audio clip in a moment, but if you use the word explain on their website, and there'll be a little box that shows you how, then you get your 10% discount. So without further ado, here's our advert.
The mist of a November dawn doesn't shroud the smell of mud, dried sweat, or the latrine. Yet there's something different in the air. Silence. The guns have stopped. So's the shouting. What next? Welcome to AudioPie's GCSE series on Germany between 1919 and 1945.
During this series, to find out more, go to www.audiopie.co.uk and quote the promo code EXPLAIN when you get to the checkout. AudioPie, inspiring education.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.